Hello, I'm Scott Soschnick.
And I'm Eben Novy Williams, and this is the Ponytail Pete Sports Business Podcast, The Sportacast.
You couldn't get a little more alliteration? Ponytail Pistol Pete? Nothing? One more P? Ponytail Pistol Pete?
We joked last week that, or a couple weeks ago, that Caitlin Clark needed a nickname. She gave herself one, Ponytail Pete, right after breaking Pistol Pete Maravich's all-time NCAA scoring record. Scott, I don't know about you, but I have even been surprised at just the attention, the fever pitch, the mania that Caitlin Clark, now officially in her final year as a college basketball player, seems to be getting as that career winds down.
That's because you're a Neanderthal.
Maybe I felt this coming.
No, this does not surprise me. She is the biggest star in college sports, male,
by a long shot, but, I think.
Yeah. By orders of magnitude. Yeah, that's your Princeton training right there. That was your Shane Battier regress to the mean line right there. Yeah, by orders of magnitude. I mean, so no, I'm not surprised. And it was building to a crescendo. Travis Scott shows up. And I always wonder on the flip side, like, is Travis Scott showing up because he really wants to see Caitlin Clark? Or is it a place to be seen so Travis Scott shows up?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both, right?
A little bit of both,
and,
right?
And I think that second thing is exactly the point that we're talking about, right?
Yes,
that
it's drawing Travis Scott.
One of the most famous artists in the world thinks that he can catch a little bit of clout by showing up at a basketball game in Iowa. There's something really big and powerful happening on that court.
Yeah, and it was very endearing where Maya Moore shows up and, like, Caitlin comes like, I'm all fangirl, you know, like, oh my God, Maya Moore's here. So
yeah,
no, I'm not surprised by it. Waiting to see the numbers. Kristen Juszczyk, of course, she had a jacket, and, you know, Jake from State Farm was there. Nobody does marketing better than them. Although it's funny, I saw somebody on Twitter say, and I love how people think just their existence and their experience is amplified to the whole world. Like, well, I've never purchased my insurance because of, but that's what advertising is about. People do, you know, the general because Shaq does the ad.
Yeah.
People do Geico because they see the gecko and they make the call. And I'm glad that's your experience. But I can guarantee you that State Farm is experiencing ROI for the investment they're making in things like this.
So I was working our Sunday shift, as you know, this past weekend. So I ended up, I would never have obviously watched the full game, but I had the whole game on in the background. It struck me that in some ways, and there's a lot of overlap here, but Caitlin Clark is getting kind of a combination of all the sports culture things that have been really relevant in the last 12 months, right? You mentioned Jake from State Farm. He showed up all over the Kelsey's. He was there. The Kristen Juszczyk's jacket, which Taylor Swift made famous.
Where was Mama Kelsey?
There was a vest for that.
Mama Kelsey should have been in Iowa.
The Fox and ESPN had crews down in Des Moines or in Iowa City for the game. We saw that with Deion Sanders this year. All of the big cultural moments that have happened in sports as crossovers in the past 12 months, Caitlin Clark seemed to be combining all of them for a single women's basketball game down in Iowa. And we haven't even talked about, Scott, maybe even the bigger news out of her camp, not just the breaking Pistol Pete's record, but she said in a social media post earlier in the week that she would not be pursuing that fifth and final COVID exemption year of eligibility, but that she would indeed be forfeiting her eligibility at the end of the year and will be joining the WNBA draft, which is music to a lot of people's ears if you are in professional women's basketball.
Well, you tell me, what was the music like to Kathy Engelbert, the commissioner of the WNBA? Because I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't think you will, that you were the first person to speak with the commissioner after the announcement that she was indeed headed to the professional ranks.
The first journalist to speak with her, yes.
Well, I think that. Yeah, sorry. Somebody, she might probably spoke to somebody else in the hallway. Jeez.
Probably. You told me to correct you if you were wrong.
I can be treated at home. I can be treated like this at home. I don't need to come to the office for it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with Kathy on Friday, and my main thrust from the conversation was, there have been a lot of commercial growth in the WNBA, just like we've seen across a lot of professional women's sports in the past few years. And she told me point blank that the W would not have been prepared to really capitalize on Caitlin Clark if this was 2019 or 2020. That it probably took a couple years of they had the best attendance in the past decade plus in the league. They had the best TV ratings I think they've had in almost 20 years. Digital, social, all those things are up. She said that the growth that they have had, and on the commercial front too, with partners, players are getting paid more, players are getting more marketing opportunities. All these things are building a framework onto which now they can layer Caitlin Clark. So yeah, I think she's obviously very excited. She's getting one of the most marketable and popular athletes in the country to join her league. But I think she's also very thankful in some ways that this was not 3 years ago, but that she's able to have a lot of things in place by the time that Caitlin comes along.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, I like when you have to dispel the notion though, like the narrative out there, well, she'll make less money.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
You know, and I'm sure Kathy touched on that, because it must really bother her. it really must bother her if the narrative is, well, now there's less money because now with NIL, she can, as if once you make that transition, now those NIL deals do end with the college eligibility or when you declare it. That's great. Yeah. But that doesn't preclude those companies from having deals with the athlete as they move into the professional ranks. So you get salary, you get bonuses, you get a whole litany of things on top of those NIL deals. And I guess we should just call them endorsement deals at this point. Yeah. She will not be, in no way, shape, or form, will Caitlin Clark be making less money as a member of the Indiana Fever than a member of the Iowa Hawkeyes basketball
team. And we could tease out some of the details here. So she has an NIL stable, as you mentioned. State Farm is in it. Gatorade is in it. Nike is in it, which we should talk about in a second.
We will.
Let's just say on the high end of anybody's estimate for Caitlin Clark, she's making $3 million a year from her NIL portfolio, right? That's a huge amount. It would be the most any women's college basketball player, probably more than any college basketball player, man or woman, is making. If not, it's fairly close. She's going to get that from whatever shoe company signs a deal with her next year.
Take out every deal.
Every other deal. Take everything off the table. Just her shoe deal is probably going to be right around that number.
You and I had a little office debate, though, desk-to-desk debate about the ROI of a Caitlin Clark sneaker. Like, how will it sell? Is it going to be in demand just because it's Caitlin? What's it going to look like? There's a whole lot that goes into a shoe. Besides sort of just the endorser, it has to look the right way. It has to be the right thing. I don't know. I'm not sold on sort of everybody buying a sneaker just because it's the Caitlin Clark.
I think the pitch, if I was Nike, if I was New Balance, if I was Puma, if I was making the pitch would be, and I think there is a chance that this is accurate also, is that Caitlin has the potential.
There's a chance that it's accurate. Oh, good.
I think Caitlin has the potential to, for the first time, be the face of a women's basketball shoe marketed towards women that women want to buy, right? In a grand scale way. You and I were looking at the SFIA numbers for basketball participation. There's about 30 million people that play basketball in the U.S. right now. Let's say something around a third, but between 30% and 40% are maybe women. Whatever percentage you want to break it out. The most popular shoes among women right now in basketball, as I understand it, are shoes like the LeBron James and the Jordans and maybe even Curry's at Under Armour. The women that have had, and there's a handful, but the women that have had their own shoe deals and shoe lines in women's basketball, to my knowledge, have not yet broken through to be the shoe that
so
women,
it's not just about a woman saying, I want to support the woman that's available, that's Sabrina Ionescu. They're not buying the shoe simply as a statement of support for the woman who has the shoe.
Yeah. And if the Clark shoe can be the Curry shoe for women who play basketball, that is a huge addressable market, right? That is exactly what all these companies want.
Are you throwing out things like Tam? Is that what you're doing right now? Did you throw out Tam without throwing out Tam?
My vocabulary suddenly became impugned on this show.
Well done. Yeah, talk about the scales of whatever it is.
So, I think that I'm sure that's probably what she wants to hear in these pitch meetings. But yeah, I think this is the big question. Is can we've never seen, at at least never in college, seen a women's basketball player get the media attention and the popularity and the commercial success that Caitlin is having. Does that translate into a shoe product that has a huge total addressable market? I think that is the question.
Okay, let's play guess the number, by the way, just for fun, because I love doing this too. I believe the high water mark for Caitlin Clark game was like 1.8 million.
Oh gosh.
I think if you know, Krupe sent me something earlier.
Set me up to fail here. Yeah.
I believe. No. Give me the number. Just give me the guess. The number. What's the number of people who tuned into that
for
last
the
game?
Ohio State game? You said the last high was 1.9. You said was the high.
I think the high is 1.8 something.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put another 20% on top of that.
Okay, so 4. So,
2. So I'm going to say 2.3. Yeah, something like that.
Okay, 2.2, 2.3.
It's going to be smart. 5.
Since I asked the question, I'm going to say I'm not making a guess. And I'm just going to see.
It's going to be 12.
Well, yeah, because you were the one that was there and watched the whole game because you were on Sunday duty.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the TV ratings, because the one of the central questions, I asked this to Kathy, you won't be surprised by her answer, but one of the central questions about the whole Caitlin Clark phenomenon right now is how much of the marketing potential and popularity of Caitlin Clark, the Iowa star, becomes the marketing potential and popularity of Caitlin Clark, the guard for the Indiana Fever. You and I talked about this a few months ago when you mentioned a poll that we had done on Twitter where more people wanted to see Caitlin Clark playing at Rutgers than wanted to see Connor Bedard playing against the Devils down the street. And I posited that I wonder if you ask that question again in a year when it was Caitlin Clark, the WNBA rookie, playing and Connor Bedard, who people want to see more. This is such a central question, right? And the TV ratings are such an interesting part of this. So we're talking about the most watched women's college, or some of the most watched women's college basketball games of all time. When Iowa was in the championship last year against LSU, it drew 9.9
multiple stars.
Million
multiple
viewers.
Stars.
Angel Reese there too. Almost 10 million, averaged almost 10 million viewers for that game. The WNBA's championship games averaged like 750,000.
Yeah.
This year's title game, which was the dream matchup, this title series, dream matchup between New York and Las Vegas, the deciding game there did less than 900,000. So just to kind of put that in context,
so she would be double right off the bat. Here's Krupe tells me that the high water mark thus far, Iowa's January 21st noon game against Ohio State on NBC, 1.85 million. Fox's high, 1.77 for the Iowa Nebraska on the afternoon of the Super Bowl, lead into the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I think we're going to go two and a half.
Great. Awesome.
Okay.
Maybe I don't look like an idiot in that, but yeah, going back to that comparison, right? So Iowa's biggest game last year, 9.9 million viewers. The biggest game in the W last year, 850,000, right? That's a huge difference. It's a 90% difference. That is the thing that she is stepping into, right? And that's the big question here, is because the baseline platform right now for national viewership for women's college basketball is so much bigger than the baseline platform right now for professional women's basketball, how much is she able to bridge the gap? It will obviously hinge a lot on how successful she is on the court as well, and that's a big piece of this as well. But I do think there is a very interesting commercial question about how much of her popularity ports over when she is playing for the Fever next year.
Yeah, I mean, just number of games, visibility of those games. We'll find out, like, the opener is going to be gangbusters because I think the schedule makers, in their infinite wisdom, said, gee, who should we put in Indiana for the home opener? Oh, I have an idea. How about the New York Liberty?
Exactly.
You know, Sabrina Ionescu, who got attention during the All-Star game, Brianna Stewart. Sure, why don't we put that title contending team in Indiana and see what we can do in terms of numbers? It's going to be gangbusters. People are definitely going to tune in.
And I have this theory that it's hard to fully articulate, but that there's something happening in the Midwest in college sports. In a lot of these big towns like Iowa City there are no pro teams anywhere nearby, but the local college team is the end all be all for sports. And you get the overlapping of people who are Iowa Hawkeyes football fans who have daughters that want to go watch college basketball. There's something kind of, and I think Nebraska's volleyball program is another good example of this. They had 100,000 people at a game last year at the football stadium. The community building around, particularly in the Midwest, a lot of these college programs that is really benefiting a lot of the women's sports that, 5 or 10 years ago were getting significantly less visibility, I think is a big thing, a moment, a vibe happening right now in college sports. And she, I think, embodies that really well. And again, the Indiana Fever don't have that. It's not something that exists in the WNBA.
You were not making a larger statement, were you, there where you were saying they don't have a professional team in the area, when I think you and I would classify these college programs as
totally
professional
fair.
Teams. I just want to make sure you weren't, you know,
totally. That is the professional team. It is Iowa Hawkeyes,
the de facto professional team.
Whether that's the football team or whether that's the women's basketball team or the softball team or the soccer team or the swim team, etc.
All right, so you were watching Caitlin Clark, and was it on the proper over the air? Were you streaming? How did you watch
this one? I was actually streaming because my antenna
really
does not get Fox that well in my apartment.
Really?
Yeah.
You just surprised the heck out of me. didn't Nadal and Alcaraz play a match? Was that on TV?
Apparently they did, Scott.
Tell me, if a tree falls in the woods.
Yeah, you have the exact same reaction that I had. Jacob Feldman, our colleague, wrote a really good story on Sunday morning about this showdown. Nadal and Alcaraz, I consider myself to be a tennis fan during majors and to essentially shut the sport off almost entirely when the majors are not going on. But Nadal, obviously a huge figure in the sport, has struggled physically. He hasn't played that much in the past few years. Alcaraz, who is everybody considers to be the next Nadal, both by playing standard and by country of origin, etc. So much about this would have been compelling to see these two guys on a court together. One of the rare few early Netflix live sports events.
Yeah.
I didn't hear a single thing about it.
That's the story. The story is that the story is the platform and how did it perform more so than sort of anything else. It's like, how many people tuned in? Did you notice? Did it get? Because
did
we're
it
all
puncture
watching,
the
what
cultural?
Do?
Yeah. Did
zeitgeist.
It puncture?
Are you going to use the word zeitgeist? Go ahead.
And I think that there's a good chance that Caitlin Clark stole a lot of this thunder.
Sure.
That there was just so much sports, social media, and media attention on her that some of this overlapped. But I think what Netflix is doing in sports is really interesting. They are not going the approach of Amazon. They are not going the approach of Apple. They have not, at least not yet, buying pricey or even semi-pricey sports assets and doing live established league games. They're kind of picking up around the edges. They're going to have WWE as entertainment. They're going to do, they did that very funny, stupid, silly, but I actually kind of enjoyed it, golf F1 overlap a few months ago, Scott. This tennis thing is another good example of kind of chipping away around the edges. I think it's a smart approach, and it's certainly different, and it's significantly cheaper than what some of their streaming competitors are doing. But I was in some ways curious to see how much chatter I would see about this tennis event, and I saw essentially none of it at all.
All right, now I'm reading the recap from our sister pub, The Hollywood Reporter, because It seems like to me this is more entertainment than sport, even though sport is a subset of entertainment. I get all that.
Sure.
But, all right, so by the way, interesting that this came from Full Day Productions. That's Connor Schell, you know, formerly of ESPN,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And David Chamberlain, brought the stars to Vegas. Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones, Charlize Theron, Lindsay Vonn, a whole bunch of people who I swear to you I don't know, but they're up high in this. So
read some names.
Embarrass yourself. I don't want to be an idiot. I don't know who these people are. But I'm going to go right to Pau Gasol, Colin Kaepernick, Matthew Stafford. Dave Grohl was on hand. Okay, so okay. I knew. I saw him. I saw the Twitter where he took in the U2 concert, the final U2, and he was really rocking out. So I saw that. To me, this is sort of like the match. You know,
it's
one-off events.
Yep.
And yeah, how would we blend the entertainment and sport, and what's the appetite for it, and who's the right participants, what's the right mix, what's the right venue? And Netflix is, once again, this is the interesting story to me, is just dipping the toe. Are we now on the first step of the pool? So obviously some people jump in the deep end and the water's cold, but Netflix is taking that measured approach down the steps. And I'm anxious to see what this did for them. Like, I don't think anybody's signing up for Netflix to watch this. It doesn't have that kind of draw. I don't think it does. This isn't sort of skinny bundle. We're going to give you a whole bunch of live sports,
yeah.
You know. So this is a whole nother animal in sort of how is Netflix going to proceed with a sports strategy. We know they looked at the World Surf League. I could buy the league so they could own the content, own the intellectual property. That's one thing. That's why you do these events. Like, it's funny when you get behind the curtain, Evan, and we talk to the people in the industry – I don't think casual fans think of it like this. This is not a tennis match. You know what this, in essence, this is intellectual property moving on a tennis court. That's what it is. You want to own IP and figure out how do you monetize that IP. Does this go global? Does the brand become something? That's what this is. So I'm not sure yet. I'm really not sure with like sort of a broken down Rafa Nadal playing a guy in his prime who's running all over the court. I'm not sure what Netflix learned from this.
And there's probably also a little bit of a tech story here in some ways.
Netflix
tried one of its first really global live events a couple years ago. It was the Love is Blind reunion. I'm embarrassed to say that I was sitting on my couch frustrated with the way
it... Blame it on your partner.
It is definitely her fault, not mine. Uh-huh. But it was a disaster. It was embarrassing. And I know for a fact that sports leagues took note of that, right? That there were I don't know how many people,
not
hundreds of thousands or
time.
Millions of people trying to get onto a live Netflix stream and the tech did not hold up to the demand. Doing little things like that golf event, for example, doing things like this tennis event is maybe a nice little test run before you suddenly do a WWE event where you have, I have no idea, but have a couple million people, plus or minus, maybe a lot or a little, have a lot of people tuning in. This actually feels like maybe it is a good way to test global tech capabilities for a live event, which is a lot harder than I think me or most sports fans would think it is.
I believe you, like I, have some sympathy. Look at me. I'm texting somebody while I'm doing this. By the way. It was an incoming call I had to respond to. Have some sympathy in that only on this podcast alone, on this platform, and we're not going to embarrass the platform, but we are thankful every time this works and that I can see you, I can hear you, and that is, and I'm on hardwire Wi-Fi. Sometimes
same.
You are. and still sometimes something goes wrong and we can't even do this. So the thought of concurrent streaming, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions, you know, nobody's picking on anybody, but you do need to learn because that is the sports game. You do want eyeballs. And if they can't see it, if there's something wrong, like you said, you're in for a really embarrassing afternoon or evening.
And a streaming service that's done really well with this is Amazon, right? The Thursday night, consistent Thursday night viewing, some of the biggest, if not the biggest, live streaming products ever put out. They've done a really good job, I think. It's not been perfect, but it's been really good. And again, leagues, rights holders, everybody takes note of that. They are aware of who has the capability that
we know
really
where the migration is, but how quickly can we reach them on those platforms?
Yep.
Like, what good is it if the audience is there, but I can't reach you, or if I'm having problems, or they're frustrated? UX matters.
Yep.
Right.
And for fans who are betting on games, obviously latency is a huge thing. There's a whole lot of folds here to that. And I think that just closing the book on Netflix, I think some of what they're doing is creating new IP that will allow them to test these things before they do the bigger stuff.
All right. Speaking of new, it's old, but it's new. Private equity in sport is old, but it's kind of new. And the NWSL is bringing in private equity. So we had like Sixth Street was an owner in a team. So it's kind of new. But now they've set the rules, which are new, which you told the world. So an old thing, but some things are new. Why don't you tell me what's new about private equity in the NWSL, leaving out Sixth Street?
Yeah, so the NWSL finally codified its owners, codified rules around what private equity funds are that invested multiple teams, and that's a big caveat, but what funds that invested multiple teams are allowed to do and not allowed to do. And we've seen this in every other major U.S. league except for the NFL. The NBA, MLB, NHL, MLS, they all set in place rules. They are restricting how many teams a fund can be invested in, how much of a team can be sold to funds. They have to be passive minority stakes, the minimum investment size, all these things. NWSL came in largely in line with, it's a smaller league from a number of team standpoint, so the percentages are maybe a little bit different, but roughly came in line with a lot of what we've seen. One notable thing that did stand out to me is that they at least separated
what they did not allow.
Sovereign wealth, at least right now. Right, which is something that the NBA, for example, and the NHL, they look at institutional capital, treat it largely similarly, whether that's a private equity fund, whether that's a pension fund, whether that's an endowment, or whether that's sovereign wealth. From what I understand and what I was told and what we reported, the NWSL, the rules that owners voted on expressly says this does not apply, at least right now, does not apply to sovereign wealth. And that's particularly notably because soccer has been the place where sovereign wealth has been able to run the most rampant globally, right? It is, there are teams owned like Newcastle, there are teams like Pierre Saint-Germain, there are teams like Manchester City. Sovereign wealth has bought some of the biggest soccer teams in the world, men's teams. And NWSL clearly thinking intentionally about its fans, who I think are among the most liberal or the more liberal that we see in U.S., how they may feel about sovereign wealth buying in if at some point we get to that point.
I can't wait for Bay Area to FC to have a team payroll of, like, you know, $400 million.
Yeah, well, the salary cap also helps in to a degree as well. But
what? Financial fair play, what?
Yeah, and again, the caveat I mentioned, which you hit on, is important, that there is a team, the Bay Area team, that is majority owned by a private equity fund, Sixth Street. These rules are specifically designed to separate that, which is a fund that owns one team, which is okay, from the idea of a fund that's investing in multiple. So if Sixth Street would not be allowed now to buy a 5% stake in Gotham, for example, right? Because then they would be in violation of some of these rules. So clearly intentionally thinking about what a private equity owned team looks like versus a private equity invested team. And then, of course, the sovereign wealth piece as well.
You know, I mean, I did set you up by going Bay Area FC. I didn't just pick that out of nowhere, even though we said we're going to leave out Sixth Street. I'll let you go right in there. All right, you want to talk two of the more fun stories in the time we have remaining?
Yeah, let's have some fun.
I'm just going to ask you the quickie, and then we'll move on to those. Reggie Bush, get the Heisman back, yes or no?
Yes, I think.
Yes, I say yes also. Okay, now let's move on to my favorite story so far, Antelope Valley. If you're not familiar with it, I'm not surprised. Not exactly a college basketball blue blood, but an NAIA school. Well, do I say, is it an NAIA school or was it?
I think
I have to go past tense, right?
Wrong
it was. Tense. So what we have here is a team without a school. We have a basketball team that where the school has ceased to exist, but they are advancing through the tournament. They are raising money from GoFundMe to keep operations going on the team and to be able to do this. I mean, Dan Libet's been all over it. This is a great sports business story where the school has gone away, but the team is looking for a way to continue. By the way, men and women.
There are so many folds to this, but you hit it. This school was running out of money. It was telegraphed for a while that they were struggling, but they essentially shut down this past week in the middle of these basketball seasons. I think both the men's and women's teams won the regular season conference tournament or regular season conference standings and are both playing in the conference tournament right now. There's an NAIA tournament after that, much like there is for an NCAA tournament. And now everybody is kind of grappling with this central idea that is, can an athlete have eligibility if his or her school no longer exists? And apparently there is some precedent for this, and my guess is they will figure out a way for this team to continue competing for the next few months. But there's a bunch of really interesting business challenges here, which is the athletes have nowhere to stay right now. The school has shut down. The former owners of the university own the dorms, but owning the dorms is not just enough, right? Because there's liability and there's taxes and there's insurance. And can you have athletes staying in dorms if there's no insurance for their well-being, for example, right? There's a whole bunch of things that are happening all at once. Because the school shut down, they lost access to their bus fleet. So they needed to crowdsource or bring money in from their founders just to get the team, just to transport the team to and from. There was a GoFundMe that was set up. There are some lawsuits involved and likely going to be some more. It's a for-profit university, and there's been a whole lot of struggles in the for-profit university world. There's a lot of different themes coming together here, and the basketball team is a really good and interesting proxy for that, because this school was, it's interesting, Scott, they were, I think it's like 600 kids and 300 of them are athletes. Like, this school is essentially an athletic department with a couple other students and some education layered on top of it. But it's going to be fascinating, and I'm sure our colleague Daniel will have the details as it comes down. But the fight to not just fund this team through the next month or so that they can play in these tournaments, but also the fight to figure out a way within the NAIA rules to maintain their eligibility is going to be a fascinating back and forth.
I'm going to test your Googling capabilities. I'm only going to read a graph, and it's not a very long graph from the story. But do you know the nickname of the school by any chance?
The University of Antelope Valley.
I don't know. Are they? Are they the Antelope Valley Antelopes? I mean, I hope they'd be more creative. I don't know.
You've gotta be the antelopes, right? Buffalo Bills vibes?
I don't know, but I'm just asking. I'm going to read the graph here. UAV was acquired in 2022 by Genius Group, a Singapore-based education technology conglomerate, which has seen its New York Stock Exchange American stock price crater by 90% over the last 6 months, trading at 33 cents a share at the close Friday. And my favorite Genius Group CEO, Roger J. Hamilton, did not respond to a request for comment. Can you tell me about your school? school's athletics.
Yeah, what's going on there?
Yeah, what's going on here? You're going to still be able to play?
They offered it. By the way, it's the Marauders.
There we go.
So which is not as cool as the Antelope.
Antelope Valley Marauders. I want a sweatshirt. I see an opportunity here. I could back this team all the way through its NAIA run. I am now rooting for UA, University of Antelope. Yeah, UAV.
Me too. Right. I'm glad you mentioned Genius Group, the parent company here, which is a publicly traded company. The coaches were offered massive salary reductions or a big chunk of their salary in Genius stock, which is down 90% over the past year. I mean, there's a lot of messiness involved here. But in terms of stories that perk up our ears, school running out of money, eligibility concerns, can they fund the buses, coaches being paid in publicly traded company stock. There's a lot in here that is
that
comes together for a great story.
We're long right now, but this has echoes of, remember you did story like somebody, I'm trying to remember, was it Team Boo Pickens or somebody who pledged money to a school based on stock price of their oil, their holdings?
Totally. Yeah, good memory. It was in Arizona. But
when
Rich Rod and Sean Miller were coaching there, a donor submitted essentially shares in an MLP, which is an energy company that spits off a bunch of dividends, and they donated the shares essentially so that the school would own the shares, the dividends would be used as bonuses for the athletic department,
for the coaches,
the AD, and then the men's basketball, women's basketball, and football coach at the time.
Which was
a very unique and interesting. Yeah, exactly. A very unique and interesting, which I had never seen before, publicly traded company shares and or dividends built into these contracts. But good memory, Scott.
Thank you. And all right, so let's end on this, and I'm going to show my sports knowledge, my on-the-field sports knowledge right now when I say some dude ran really fast, a 40 or 100 at the NFL Combine?
Yeah.
I don't even know how far they run anymore. I just remember Darren Revelle's doing it, so I still laugh at that. Still one of my favorite videos
faster
ever.
Than Darren, this guy.
Yeah, faster than Darren. So some dude ran really fast, and you said something about, like, you could have had a private island, and of course I read that story because I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah, this is maybe interesting only in my own head, but...
No. Once it got out of your head, I was interested too.
Xavier Worthy, who is a star wide receiver at Texas Austin, at the Combine last week, ran the fastest combine 40 yard dash ever.
Is he a track dude also?
I don't know, but it certainly seems like he should have been.
Yeah, exactly.
in the aftermath. And he did it in Adidas shoes, which stuck out to me because a number of years ago, back in 2017, Adidas had a big splashy promotion where anyone who broke the 40 yard dash record in Adidas cleats, they would buy either a private island or give $1 million in cash to. Which is clearly a promotion designed at just getting attention, right? The fact that you're tossing in the island there, I can't imagine anyone would have taken this and taken the island. But it struck me as funny and interesting that Xavier Worthy, 6 years later, did exactly this. He broke the 40-yard dash time. He did it in Adidas cleats. I reached out to Adidas to ask if they were doing anything for him. It doesn't sound like they are.
Hell no.
But, in a different world, if this had been a little earlier or if the promotion had gone along longer, Xavier Worthy might have won $1 million or a private island as part of his being the fastest person to ever run at the Combine.
Now, time for me to praise you that you remembered that. Like you're saying, me, I remember Rich Rod, whatever story that I read. I even got it wrong. I thought it was T. Boone Pickens, but I was good. You remembered that. I forget about remembering it. I never even heard of that. I do not remember Adidas.
I think I wrote about
this promotion.
At Bloomberg is why it's in my mind.
Maybe it's one of those days where I was off and I didn't catch your stellar
Very
copy.
Possible.
Could be. All right, close the show, my man. We're long.
All right. He is Scott Soschnick. You can find him on his private island, also known as
New Jersey
in Manhattan. You can find him on Twitter at Soschnick. I am Evan Novi Williams on Twitter at Novi.
Wait, did you just say
Williams?
New Jersey and Manhattan at the same time? That doesn't make sense.
I was going to give your hometown, but then I wasn't sure if you wanted me to give the hometown.
No, I don't want anybody to know where I live. I don't want protests.
So I said New Jersey.
Autograph seekers and... Man, no, I don't want that.
Our show is produced by Aaron Greenewald. Thank you to Aaron. We will not tell you where Aaron Greenewald lives. Neither will we share the location of Cora Veltman, our social media editor.
Evan lives in Washington Heights.
I'd like you to know, I am in Washington Heights, that you can download the show at Sportacast, which is the hub of the Sportico
Manuel
Media
Novi Williams.